Welcome back to this week's episode of Toys on Tap. This week is huge with Mile High Sifubi coming on. Paul is killing it in the Sifubi game and is doing so much incredible stuff for the toy community. If you want more Toys on Tap, you can like, follow, rate, review, subscribe wherever you get this podcast. If you want to jump on and support in a free way, follow us on all socials at Toys on Tap. And if you want to support the show even more, you can jump on the Patreon, patreon.com/toysontap. That's where the nitty gritty goes. That's where the video interview goes. And this week on the Patreon, you get to hear all about how soft vinyl is made. So we are pumped. Now let's get to this week's episode, Toys on Tap.
Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Oh, jeez. I was going to use the headset, but it's not going to let me do that today. All right, man. Technology for me.
Yeah, it's all right. It's worth it. I'm pumped that you're on because I wanted to talk to you for a while. And if it's a headset that's the issue, we'll get rid of it easily.
Here we go. Done.
Nice. Okay. Thanks for working out the time with me. I know you're a busy guy, especially with 5 points coming up. So thank you so much.
Thanks for being so flexible, man. Yeah, no problem. I'm glad we could chat. This is going to be fun.
It was the worst part was my initial email that went out to you through an email that like I never use. And so all the time that I've been responding, or if it's late, it's because I have to get into a different account. It's so crazy.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So I might move it over to the Toys on Tap account, but I'm pumped. I'm really excited because like I now get to work with you as well. So I now get to like hear all the backstory of what you've got going on.
Cool. Yeah, that's exciting, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm pumped. But before we start anything, please introduce yourself. Tell us who you are and what you do.
My name is Paul Shagula. I run Mile High Sifubi, which is a little tiny one-person factory here in Denver, Colorado.
Yeah. Are you the only one in the U.S. that's producing?
I think I'm the only one doing it full-time. I know that for sure.
Holy moly.
Yeah, I do 5 days a week, sometimes 6 days a week, depending how busy I am. And then.
Yeah. And I've seen the setup. I do want to talk about your workspace. It doesn't look massive, so you're cranking.
Yeah, it's a tiny space. I mean, it's about two-thirds of a single car garage is about the space that I have.
Okay. Yeah. Holy moly. Before we do anything, if you have heard any episode of Toys on Tap, I love to get to know the artist before they were the artist. So taking me all the way back to when you were a kid, tell me about the toys you collected, all the toys you had, the cartoons, all that stuff.
Awesome. Yeah, it's because that's so much a part of us. It really is. You know, it makes us who we are, especially my own self. And I know you too, for that matter. Growing up, I was a monster kid, a total monster kid. I think I was 8, 9 years old when I discovered Famous Monsters, a Film Man magazine.
Yeah.
I just loved it. And my grandma was so cool. She knew how much I loved it. And my birthday rolled around. She says, "What do you want?" I said, "I want a subscription." So she bought me a subscription to Famous Monsters, probably the turning point in my life, you know. And I would haunt the mailbox every day. You know, summer months, the mailman hated coming to the house because it was always there. Anything for me? Anything for me? And, you know, so it was great. You know, I grew up in a big Italian family. 5 kids. Sunday would come, you know, get the Sunday newspaper. And I'm the youngest of the boys. I have a sister younger than me, so I have 3 older brothers. And everyone would fight for their piece of the newspaper. And I would wait till the fray ended because nobody ever grabbed the TV guide. That's what I would grab.
Yeah.
So I grabbed the TV guide. This is all before VCRs, right? So I'd grab the TV guide and sit down and then just with a pen start circling all the monster movies I hadn't seen on all week, you know, and then try to work out so I could watch them. And I was really lucky. I'm lucky on a lot of fronts with my parents. My folks recognized I had artistic talent as a young man and they fostered that. And they also knew my interest in horror movies. So they were so cool. I would like say, hey, you know, there's this horror movie on at 1 o'clock in the morning. If I set an alarm, get up real quick, can I watch it? And they'll be like, yeah, go ahead, you know. So
nice.
You know, back then it was like, if you didn't see it, you may never see it again.
Yeah, I remember, you know, I'm only 33, so like I'm at the cusp of when the TV guide still existed. And I remember looking at that thing and just like trying to figure out if I could plan my day out to see a movie, and I hated it.
You just ruled by that box, you know?
Yeah,
it's true.
That's crazy. And I'm glad that they like fostered that and said like, yeah, get up early, watch whatever you got going on. Like, that's amazing.
It was really cool. It was really cool. It was great for a while. Then my mom got on this no violence kick for a while. It was really interesting. And so I'm sitting, my sister and I are watching a movie on a Saturday afternoon, and it was called A Manster. Mm-hmm. Great movie. Japanese-American joint, as they say. And so we're watching, it gets to toward the end, like the last 10, 15 minutes, and then there's some gunfire. And my mom hears the gunfire. She comes in, nope, that's violence, and she turns it off. It took me 20 years to see the end of that movie. Finally, when it was released on video, I bought the dang video, and it was like, oh, I finally know how it ends. You know, it was like, oh my gosh.
Holy moly. So did that kind of like adjust what you played with as a kid with toys as well?
Yeah. You know, I tried to find monster toys when back then, and there wasn't a whole heck of a lot of stuff being made. There were, of course, the Marx plastic toys and, you know, non-articulated, but really neat sculpts and stuff. And of course, the Aurora Monster model kits, man. I had them all.
Yeah.
I loved them all. They were so cool. And that really got me into building model kits as a kiddo. And so from there, you know, I moved on, and I would carve out of wood and soft stone and things like that. And then my father wanted to take an oil painting class. So he came in and said, hey, because he also was a painter when he had time. Mm-hmm. And he said, hey, I'm going to take this oil painting class you want to take with me. And I said, I'd love to, Dad. Yeah. So him and I would join this oil painting class, and I learned to use oils and paint, and that was really fun. And I just really, from then on, wanted to be an artist. That's really set the tone for me. So like other toys, I'm trying to think, there wasn't a whole lot. I had made a lot of stuff that I wanted.
Yeah.
You know? That's what got me here, because it's like, you know, I want a toy like this I can play with, dang it, you know. And then they weren't around, you know, I couldn't get a hold of them. So.
Yeah. As you go, what is your artistic career kind of it start as? Are you in high school and stuff doing only art? Do you go to college for art? What does that look like growing up as an artist?
That was, yeah, I was really lucky from the transition from junior high to high school. Freshmen weren't allowed to take art classes in high school when I was then. And my mom, unbeknownst to me, she went down and talked to the art teacher and said, hey, you know, my son's really into it, blah, 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 blah. And they said, oh, well, we'll waive that. He can go and take art classes in this freshman year then. So I got right in on the ground floor, started taking all the art classes throughout high school. Really exciting, really fun, you know. We didn't have a lot of money. We were a poor working class Italian family. So when it came to college, we've got a great college here. It was Metro State College. Yeah. It's the state college here in Denver. Now it's a university. So I guess I went to university. And so I went there and studied fine arts. And I started as a drawing major and did that for the first year and a half. And then I had to pick up a ceramics class for some of the credits I had to get. I really got into ceramic sculpture. Did that for a while. Then jumped headfirst into sculpting, metal sculpting, wax sculpting, wood sculpting, just went ape and just had a great time. I stayed a few extra years and picked up a graphic arts degree, which now pretty much with all the cool stuff that you can do now with computer. From there, when I graduated, I worked full-time in school and went full-time in school. So that was kind of a challenge, but I did it. So I worked full time and I kept trying to create art and getting into shows around Denver. And it was weird back then in Denver in the mid 80s. There were just a few indie galleries and there were gatekeepers. Mm-hmm. To get through the gatekeepers. So a buddy of mine decided, well, hell, you know, we rented this house together. Right next door was a old garage. So why don't we check it out? And we checked it out. It was a great shape place for a gallery. So we started a gallery there. It was Cutthroat Art Space was the name of it. Yeah. Yeah. Well, we were putting out a fanzine at the same time called Cutthroat. There's all this wild Xerox art that we're doing. I worked at Kinko's Copies at the time, so I had all that great stuff available to me. So I was doing a lot of cool collage work. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
And that was fun. And so we did the Cutthroat Art Space and had that going for 2, maybe 3 years. And Ravina had to shut down. It was really a financial drain on us. But it was so much fun. We got a lot of great artists that came through there.
I love stories like that because you take something. I mean, that's kind of why I'm like moving into production. Like you have one bad experience because someone's a gatekeeper or something. And then it's like, no, I'm just going to beat you at it. I'm going to do it and have fun and like just do what I want to do.
Exactly. That's what you have to persevere. I mean, that's the key thing for any artist is perseverance, really. Keep swinging, man. You know, you've got to. So I went on with the gallery. Once the gallery closed, I had more time. I started, and then it was in the early 90s, and I discovered garage kits, which came out of Japan initially. And it was really big here in the early 90s. And so I started sculpting and casting resin and making my own garage kits. I did some knockoff Planet of the Apes stuff. I did a really cool half-zombie, which at the time, everyone was like, oh, it's so gross. But now it's like, whatever, you know, it's my art compared, you know, and a bunch of fun stuff like that. And then would eventually got into going to Wonderfest here in the U.S. in Louisville and joining. That's a garage kit show and we present there. Then I transitioned. I thought, you know, there's a split here. People who want to build kits want to do it from the ground up, all the pieces, paint it, prime it, all that stuff. And then there's other people who say, I can't do that. I want, can I get it pre-painted? I decided, well, let me look into this. And a good friend of mine was doing some work with the Boy Scouts in China. He said, contact these people. And so I talked to him and found a way to make pre-painted statues in China. So I started producing stuff. I did an It Terror, It Conquered the World, the Beulah figure, pre-painted the base and little flying mind control units and did a Invasion of the Saucer Man, about 14 inches tall, and all manner of different stuff. And Little Hercules from Beast from a Million Eyes, which you see for like 15 seconds at the end of the movie. So Paul Blaisdell really influenced me. Those were Paul Blaisdell monsters. And he was a special effects guy that Roger Corman tapped back in the day. And he was a big hero of mine. And so I love his movies. I love his creatures.
Yeah.
That really got me started in production in China in a way. Yeah.
I mean, what year are we at about in this point?
I would say at that point it was probably 96, 97.
That is so early to be doing independent production, working with factories and stuff. So that's, I mean, and to get those statues, do any of them exist? Do you have them still?
I've got copies for myself here. Yeah. I've got them all around the house. I've got on different displays. I don't have them here in my office, unfortunately. I showed you. I can send you some pictures. So.
Awesome.
Yeah, that was really fun, you know, to do that. And, but to reel it back a bit, you know, back to the garage kit days, I discovered Billiken vinyl kits. And I'm like, what the heck is this? You know, at the same time I discovered Billiken, I discovered the Bandai Ultraman and Godzilla figures. In being in Denver, there wasn't a lot of Asian influence. It was hard to see Ultraman on TV or things like that. So I caught a few glimpses of Ultraman as a kiddo, and it really stuck up here. And of course, Godzilla I loved. They, you know, they'd have Godzilla marathons on TV, and I would haunt those. So as I got older, I was collecting Bandai vinyl toys and then the Billiken vinyl kits together. And the thing just fascinated me, the whole concept of vinyl casting fast. That's really where I think the impetus of it has started.
Which is so interesting. Like, I think growing up, even in the 90s, my first, I didn't know about Godzilla until maybe 2000 when one of the movies came out. And even then, it wasn't a part of my, like, zeitgeist. So I had no concept of who Godzilla was or what it was. And so like, but from what I understand, early on in the US, we had toys somehow creeping in, all that kind of stuff too.
Very few made it to Denver, but the coastal cities were really lucky because they had the great Asian influence and stuff would creep in, you know?
Yeah.
Well, geez, there was one day I was at a thrift store and I'm jumping up here so I can show it to you. I come across. Of course, all my toys are going to fall. I can't find it right off the bat. It was an Ultra. Oh, here it is. Ultraman Taro book at a thrift store.
Whoa.
Slipcase. Beautiful little book. Oh, excuse me. Ultraman Ace. Wrong guy. It's just, you know, it's filled with all the blow apart pictures and all this stuff. And it was just like, this is heaven. This is just absolute heaven for me, you know? Finding this here in Denver, it was a shock. It was a shock. So I just coveted this thing, and it just fueled the fire more for Japanese toys. It really, really did. And I started going hog wild in the 90s when the internet started burgeoning out and finding stuff on eBay and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, and that's still really early. How did you even know? I think the hard part is social media is not a thing. MySpace doesn't even creep in until way later. And so how do you even know what to type in? How do you know what to find? How do you, because it's just like Japanese toy can only bring you so much.
Right. And it was really limited to what was out there. I mean, most of the collectors I was buying from were people who were on secondary market here in the US.
Mm-hmm.
And probably about 93, 94, there's a guy opened a shop in Aurora, Colorado, a suburb of Denver. And he was selling garage kits, but he also had just a full line of Bandai vinyl toys. But I'd go down there and drool them and eke out one or two when I could and stuff. So that's kind of how I built locally. But then the rest of the stuff I pretty much got online.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, it's funny because at the same time, growing up here in Denver, there were a lot of Hispanic theaters. And they would show Lucha Libre movies, Luchador movies. And then I got into the mass wrestler stuff back then. And I was like, oh my God, you know, what a great world. I've got the Japanese here, I've got the Mexican wrestling here, and they're both just wonderful fantasy worlds. And I just dived into it, you know. And then I started collecting movie posters for, well, I started collecting movie posters. That was an addiction that I went down a road back then. And I'm glad I did it then, because now there's no way I could afford to even get into movie posters. I mean, I'll tell you what, I used to pick up lots of 50, 75 posters, dollar a piece. And I'd come back and I'd look through the whole lot. And today, some of the stuff that I have, I can't even believe I own it. I really can't. It's outrageous, the prices.
So help you, what I'm hearing is you have a collector personality.
I'm
because
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can I'm in it, I'm there yeah. And so the reality of starting to, you said something that was so like, I would snag one when I could, like that's the real life of a collector. And then to start going into movie posters, which are not small. And no. So you're trying to like figure a way to store these and display and all that stuff. How did you first get into movie posters as it relates to like vinyl and toy and all that?
Being a big movie fan, I was, I thought the closest thing to owning a piece of that movie would be owning a piece of paper from that movie. That's the closest thing that I'd ever have. So that's what really inspired me. It was like, dang, this was original. It was released at the time. And there were some friends I knew that had been collecting before me. And they had, you know, I was a Teenage Frankenstein one sheets. And I was just like in awe of that. And the Humphrey Bogart, Tokyo Joe, this guy I knew had a subway sheet of that. It was like, oh my gosh, you know, the artwork is so beautiful. And then the whole tie to the movies. And it was just like, oh, you know, this is the world. This is the life, you know? And, so yeah, I could find stuff here. Luckily, there were some shops here that I could find stuff, or individual people who collected and said, I'm done, get rid of all this stuff. And, you know, then I would swoop in and get what I could. We were lucky in the 90s, there were a lot more shows in Denver. Now there's not a lot of conventions. And we had a gentleman here who had an antique store, a collectible store in Denver, and he would put on different conventions every other week. He would bounce back and forth between two venues and have different kinds of conventions. And every now and again, Eric Caden from Hollywood Book and Poster in LA would drive out. And when he went, man, I mean, I would call Eric and say, you're coming up to the show. And he goes, yeah. I said, man, bring what you've got, Mexican wrestling, and bring this and bring that. And then I would save my money, save my money, save my money. And I'd go just give it all to Eric. and then, you know, buy all his posters and stills and lobby cards. And it was so cool. That was such a fun time, you know.
What's fascinating about Toys on Tap and all the artists that I encounter. So, I mean, we all collect toys. I can see behind you and all the toys that we have. But the world of collecting, like, you can collect anything. And movie posters wasn't anything I used to collect. What's the closest thing I got to movie posters? And this is, I went through a weird thing of thievery growing up. When I was in college, bus bench ads, like they were massive posters. And we realized that it was a simple tool you could get at Ace Hardware that would just open them. And they were only clipped in by those binder clips. And so we, any movie, any Broadway show, anything that came out, we were taking them. And then we covered our walls with them at our apartment. Not, awesome. Yeah, none of them were worth anything because they were all brand new. None of them really mattered. But it was like, I just didn't know that people collected things like that. And I like, the world has been opened through this podcast, which is weird.
Yeah, the artwork, especially the Mexican posters, are fascinating. Oh my gosh, they're beautiful. Such action, you know, there's so much action. Every movie you see that's done, released by a Mexican studio, you're like, it's got to be exciting. Just look at that artwork, you know. It may not be, but it was like, damn, I want to see that, you know.
It reminds me, there's that, is it Deadly Prey in Ghana? There's a gallery that paints them all. And I've seen Dove as he, like, sends them, like, paint these things. And they paint the craziest things. And I want every single one of them.
They're wild, aren't they?
Yeah. It's like, how did you even think about that? That's so crazy. So as you are progressing through this, you're already making statues like standalones in China. What's next that comes after that? Do you start trying to figure out how to produce bigger, more different stuff?
Yeah, basically. Yeah. I try to exhaust everything that I could that I thought I wanted. The key was, if I wanted it, I assumed at least somebody out there would want it. So yeah, I kept going. I think eventually one of the last things I did, or one of the biggest things I did, was a 1-to-1 scale Tingler from the movie The Tingler. And they made those for me. And yeah, and then it got to the point where
Empire Blister. Empire Blisters. Specializing in action figure blisters. 3.75 inch or 182. 19 different styles. Two sizes of clamshell figure cases. Four different bulk pack options. Quantities of 100 sample packs available. Empire Blisters.
Now functional Toys on Tap.
That means a 10% off coupon on checkout. Use code Toys on Tap 10. That's COYSONTAP 10.
Empire Blisters. Empire Blisters.
It really wasn't panning out so good financially, and I was kind of going in the hole on my last few projects. So I backed away from that for a while and just kind of focused on just doing my own sculpting for a while. And I don't know, I guess, but I've always wanted to do vinyl, but could never figure out how to do it. So my next step was to basically figure out what else can I do that's like vinyl. So I experimented with some materials. And I found out that I also used to make latex masks. Mm. So I found out that neoprene, which is it's a synthetic latex. And neoprene comes in various hardnesses. It can be really flexible, like a diving suit or swimming suit, you know, for people who do deep sea diving and stuff. Or it can be hard as vinyl. I thought, well, hold the phone. That's really interesting. So I did a little more research and then found out I could use dental stone for the molds. But okay, I'm a pretty good mold maker. So I started sculpting my own figures. First one I did was Creature of Terror. It's from a movie called Island of Terror with Peter Cushing. This is just a crazy colorway my wife really likes, so I gave it to her. It was one of the first ones I made. And so this is made out of neoprene, and it's cast hollow, just like vinyl. And it's pretty cool. It's really neat how it worked. And I thought, well, dang, this is what I'm going to do. So I started making different toys. I did And I focus on the Mexican toy, Mexican monsters. And so I did, I found a movie I really, really liked that I wanted to focus on. It was called Ship of Monsters. So I started doing all the monsters for those and making them in the neoprene. And it was great, except you got to use a two-part mold and you have seam line. So what do you have to do with seam line? Well, you got to sand them.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to casting, like, this is what I found. This is one of the neoprene castings that I had found when I was moving. So this thing's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 parts. You know, if I'm going to do a run of 30, multiply that times 30, and I got to sand every single part. Spend hours and hours and hours with Dremel and sanding and getting them all ready just so I can paint them. And, you know, it was fun. It was fun. And it was cool for me able to do it. But it was like, dang it, I'm sick of sanding. I'm spending all this time sanding. I'm not doing anything else, you know. So I thought, I've got to figure out how to do vinyl. And so I started putting my brain to it. And because I did have roots in the garage kit world, there was one guy, his name is George Stevenson. And great guy in Minnesota. He used to run a company called Geometric Model Kits. And Geometric was pulling vinyl model kits in Minnesota back in the 90s. And so I knew George, and so I gave him a call. And he's a very busy guy. He was at the time, well, he's now retired, but he was a judge in Minnesota. So he's a very busy man, but he gave me time. And he said, listen, Paul, what I know I did 30 years ago. So all this technology that I'm going to tell you about is probably doesn't even exist anymore. You're going to have to figure out a lot of it on your own. So he gave me the bare bones. This is basically how it works, but you can kind of put it together from there. So it took me 3 years to figure out where to source everything, what to do. It's like, what am I going to do for a curing tank, right? What am I going to do for that? And so I thought, well, shoot, I don't know. So I started putting my head to it, and I thought, well, hell, I've got ceramic experience. Electric kiln's a big stove, big oven. Why couldn't I use that? So I called this company, and we talked for a while. It took about 45 minutes to make me understand, make them understand what I was trying to do. Yeah, we can do that because we also do annealing tanks for people who make swords and knives. I thought, oh, well, gosh, you know, that's got the software and the concept that I'm going for, basically. So they built a kiln for me and sent it to me. And then I contacted a fabricator here who made a stainless steel liner to drop into it. So I put that in there and then sourced the salt to put in there and melt it down. And that's really how it all started from there. You know, then I had to figure out, there was more elements. It was like, what do I do? Do I build a spinner to spin the mold? That's where I went down that rabbit hole for about 9-10 months. It was like, I can't do it. I just can't do it. It's just not going to work. I used a washing machine. I used everything under the sun that I can't do. And I said, well, the alternative is a vacuum chamber. So finally looked around and found a used vacuum chamber in California, and they sent it out to me, and that worked. It pulled the bubbles out of the molds. It was like, oh my gosh, I'm getting this. I'm getting it together, you know? And then it took me a while to really feel comfortable with it. You know, I had my own design that I was working with, just my own molds, for a long time, just learning what I needed to do. And that was probably 2017, 2018. Yeah. Throughout those years, I finally put it all together. And then by 2019, I opened the business officially at Mile High Sofa Bank.
You were kind of just marching forward, not knowing what was going to happen.
Yeah, ignorance marches on, man. Yeah.
Yeah. And so as you're doing this, any resin caster will say, like, the first stuff that you buy, it's going to get wasted because you don't know how to do it. And you're kind of like, and so you're just burning money. And you were like going through money at no shortage, having things built and all that stuff. So walk me in that 10 months where you're still trying to figure out what to do. You don't have a vacuum chamber yet. Walk me through that mental process of like, what am I doing? I'm like thousands into this. What am I going to do?
Oh my word. There were so many times I'd come in so dejected. And Barb, my wife, who was my rock, she'd say, no, hell no. Pull yourself up, get your shit together, and get on it. You can figure this out. You know, she was just so supportive through the whole thing. You know, she kicked me in the ass when I needed it. But man, it was tough because sometimes you just say, I'm never going to figure this out. It's just not going to work. You know, there's so many times I want to just give up, just walk away. And then, you know, back here in the back of my head, and then Barb kicking me in the rear, you know, it was like, I can't. I've come this far. I cannot back off, you know. But that was a hard 10 months. It really was, you know. And like you said, I had money invested. It was like, what do I do? Walk away from all this and, you know, take the loss. And hey, I'm not a rich man by any stretch of the imagination. I worked in the grocery business for 25 years. So, you know, I'm a blue collar guy, and I didn't just figured, you know, heck, you know, I was working full time and trying to figure all this stuff out at the same time. And yeah, it really got frustrating. But then when I finally got the vacuum chamber, it really started to come together. It was like, oh my gosh. Yeah, this is going to work, you know. Then I had to branch out and figure all the other little elements to it. So,
yeah. And not only did you like make it work for your own stuff, you opened Mile High Safubi, which I'm assuming the name references Colorado being up on the right.
Denver. Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. What's interesting about that is then when you open that, people can now like order through you and you make their stuff. That's because now it's someone else's. Like if you mess up your own, it is what it is, but now it's someone else's. Yeah. So those first few projects that come in, because you're the first American that's doing Safubi like this full time, what's happening? What are you, or because it's all brand new, how are you feeling in those first couple?
I was nervous as heck, nervous as a cat in a room full of rocking chairs. I mean, oh, because, you know, you, like you said, you're dealing with somebody else's money. You're dealing with somebody else's creativity, their artistic vision, and you don't want to mess that up. You know, I was very sensitive to that. And lucky I had some great folks to start with. Jeff DeSantis was one of my first customers. Pete from BXE Buttons, he came to me with one of his first pieces, and they were just lovely guys to start with because they were wonderful, sweet guys, understanding, great designs. They had fun designs. And yeah, I mean, they still come to me for stuff. It's fantastic. I love them both. And it's like, wow, you know, that was a deep down inside. Oh, Benny from Tenacious Toys was one of the first people. In fact, in 2019, when I finally got a table at Econ and was pushing Mile High Sofa BS open, Barb and I drove from Denver to LA, and as we were just coming into the basin in LA, the phone rings, the Bluetooth rings over the car, and it's Benny from New York going, Paul, how the heck are you, man? I've been wanting to talk to you about a project and blah, 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 blah. And he came on board with his Danger Dogs right away. He said, I can't wait, Paul. This is so exciting. He's been a big champion for me for years now, and a good friend. I mean, Benny and I are friends. I love him. He's a great man.
That's incredible. And then moving into, so 2019-ish, 2018, you open up and you come up with a logo that kind of looks like Hedora a little bit, which I love, has that like, I love it. And the shirt, yeah, all these things. So one, how did you come up with the logo? And then people are now drawing these, like your new Instagram profile photo is incredible. Drew drew it for you, I think.
Yeah, Drew White. Yeah, he's so fun. Yeah.
Insanely good. And so how are you, one, coming up with a logo, and then as you're approaching something like DesignerCon, if you're open for bit, you're kind of just there. It becomes almost a money pit because you're just, hey, I'm here. So tell me about that. How did you know that was the thing you needed to do and that was where you were headed?
Well, it took me a while to get into DesignerCon initially. A friend of mine had told me about it. I used to do Monsterpalooza all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Loved it. Loved the show. I'd like to get back. But loved the show. Had a great time. But a friend of mine, Keith Rainville, he had said, you know, Paul, I think you're going to do better at DesignerCon than you would here at Monsterpalooza. Things started to level off there. I was making money, but I was breaking even, basically. He says, I think DesignerCon's the really show for you. So I contacted Ben, and he threw me on a wait list. And in 2018, Barb and I had gone on vacation, and I come back to an email was like 4 weeks before the show, and it says, "Hey, I got a table for you." I'm like, "Oh gosh, oh my gosh!" So I threw everything together and got out to that show, and that's initially started it for me, you know, just to get out there. And it was really before the business was up and running. Okay, it was a week year before, so. Yeah, so that was a good show, and then I was able to get a table the next time for the next show, because then I was already in, and so I got a table for the next show, and that's where 2019 was like, oh my gosh, man, Abraham, I've never seen such a reaction to what I was doing. I mean, I had people lined up at the table, and I talked 2.5 days straight to people. I lost my voice Sunday afternoon from talking to people all that time, and it was fascinating, the response and the interest. And that really, I think, it put me on the map. People started then coming to me more and bringing projects to me, and we discuss them and work them out. So that really was a boon for me.
It was, I mean, I don't know much about Sifubi. And I that's why I love that you're on, because I have Sifubi pieces. I absolutely love them. And but because I don't know much about it, I never dabbled in it. I just stayed with resin. And I just was making that way and doing that kind of stuff. But now doing this and seeing, and then I think just like a good thing about DesignerCon is it works, because that's where I met you at this last DesignerCon. And so it doesn't shock me that there was a huge reception, being that you were now taking on projects and trying to figure out like, how do we make your dream come to life? How do we do all these things? And now we're 6 years in, six-ish years?
Yeah, well, coming September, yeah.
So over the 6 years, how many projects have you worked with? Hundreds, right?
At least 100.
Okay.
Yeah, I stopped counting. I just was like, oh, I lost track. The shelf over here. Got a little bit you can see. Mm-hmm. Some of the projects that, well, I usually try to keep one piece for me to put on the shelf, you know, the record of what I've done, kind of a thing. And it's crazy, I gotta put up more shelves. It's nuts. I don't know exactly. I should stop someday and count, but I don't have time. No, I'm running out of room for molds. I'm tripping over molds anymore.
So I also like the mold process is crazy to me. Like when you first get in, they're like, oh, it's $10,000 to go create a mold. It's not $10,000 to create a mold, especially with what you like different things that you need. But I was looking at mold stuff and I saw Wonder Goblin. I don't know his actual name.
We interrupt this broadcast of Toys on Tap to bring you this.
Meanwhile, in a galaxy of bootleg treasures.
DOV2, we have engine failure. We must crash land on DKE Toy Planet.
Oh my, we're doomed.
Wait, salvation. Hooray, we're saved, DOV2. Limited edition custom artist made action figures and DKE toys.
Check out www.dketoys.com for a full catalog.
Hooray for custom action figures.
DKE.
Nice, yeah, guy. Yeah. And so he went to Tokyo, I think, and took a picture of this massive room, and they're just climbing over molds. And it's like, in my head, if I paid for a mold, that is gold for me.
Yeah.
But for them, it was like, we've got so many of these things. Just climb over the mountain and pick one.
Yeah. I think I know the picture you're talking about, because I was stunned. It's like, oh my word.
Yeah.
How do I sort it all, you know?
God forbid there's one at the bottom that they're like, I need that. What are you doing?
Because that would always be the one you need, right?
Yeah. Because I think what's incredible, or it's kind of an incredible thing. When we think about molds, especially if you work with action figures, it's injection molding. So the mold really could be the size of a soda can if it was done crazy small. But these molds are not that. They're big, they're bulky, and it's like negative space. And so what do you do? Do you just store these in a facility, just hoping that you don't lose them?
I got one big ass shelf out there full, and I got another smaller shelf full.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much, there's attic space in where I work that I box things and label them and I put them up there. So then every now and again, I got to claw up the ladder and then poke around with a flashlight and read all the boxes and make sure that's the right mold and get it down. Stuff like that. So that's what I've been doing. Neil Ewing says, Paul, there's a storage place right up the street. I said, yeah, but I don't want to pay the monthly charge. You know what a cheap bastard I am.
Yeah.
He laughed his ass off.
One of my, I think the favorite things about you as a creator and why I've wanted to get you on is because you'll post pictures with other creators that I love. Like I love Neil. He is one of my favorite people. And in working, especially with something like Toys on Tap, it's all relationship based. And so Neil was the one that was like, go talk to Paul. Like if you want to do this, go do this. And so it was cool to be able to do that. And then to see you posting favorite artists that I like and having like Ophelia Toys at your booth where the toy, and it's like incredible. So I thank you for doing what you do.
Oh, gosh, you're welcome. I'm glad I can do it. I'm glad I can do it. I really am. It's yeah, it's amazing, man. It really is. I love those guys. God, Ryan moved from Denver, unfortunately. He's in Illinois now. Mm-hmm. I miss him madly. He's my breakfast buddy. And when I would do his pulls, then I would call him and say, hey, buddy, it's all done. You want me to send it to you? Or and he goes, oh, no. What are you doing next Tuesday morning? I said, what's up? He goes, let's go to breakfast and I'll pick up my stuff. So we'd go out breakfast, chat for a couple hours, and he'd get his stuff. It was just such a fun thing to do. And I miss him, but I love him madly. Love Ryan. Love Neil. They're my homies. You know, love them both. Great guys.
Yeah. So, I mean, I always have to ask every artist with all of the stuff that you've created, what you're currently doing. You're doing the circuit run with Decon, and are you still doing Monsterpalooza? Not this year, right?
No. I want to get back. I'll probably go as a civilian.
Yeah.
And just see everybody I know there. But and then talk to. I think Ben still runs it. I have to go talk to him. There's another band that runs Monsterpalooza. Not to confuse the two bands and shows.
And so the question always comes, what's next for Mile High Sifubi?
Oh, work faster. No. Just keep going. Persevere. Just keep going. There's a lot of work to do. Always something to do here. Always a project going on or an element of a project that I have to work with. So I just keep swinging. You know, it's just me. So I'll do this. I'm going to do it till I draw. That's what I've told Drew Toe, another good friend of mine from Unaffiliated Toys. Yeah, I told him, he said, Paul, what are you going to do, man? I said, I'm going to keep going till I draw. You know, I'm going to make toys until I can't do it anymore physically. So because, oh, that's great. Don't you go anywhere.
Don't you?
He told me, become a vegetarian. Start exercising more. He gets to tell me all this stuff. It's like,
yeah. How funny. I have a couple more questions and then we'll head into the end and we'll close it. But every artist has something called the nitty gritty, which is an extra part that goes on the Patreon. It's artist specific. So I'm excited for that one. Cool. But especially because you're into vinyl and all these like things from different countries. Tell me about a grail piece that you don't have.
One of them would be the dragon from Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. Love to get my hands on. Always elusive. I never have the money when it shows up. It's like, I really want this. What's another one that I've been really, really, really wanting? I do. You know what? I'm sorely lacking in Megalon and Gigan pieces, but I want specific ones, and all of them that I want are so darn hard to get a hold of. There's so many. I'm a weird collector too, because it's like I'll walk into a show and it's like, oh, these are great. Oh, cool. That's great. And then here's somebody with all this vintage stuff and I'll just go stare for hours. Oh my God. Oh, gee. Oh, wow. And then I look at the price tag and go, oh, nice. Now back on the show.
Yeah.
That's what kills me a lot of times. But yeah, I would like to get that dragon though, darn it. That's one thing I'd really like to zero in on.
Yeah. I love talking grail pieces with people because it's, they're grail for a reason. They're absolutely elusive. And on the side of my wall right here is Ninja Turtle bootlegs from different countries. And there's one from South Korea that it's called Our Friend Power 5. And it's a robot that's like massive and turtles fit into it and they're different colors. And it's like, every time it pops up, it's like $600 to $700 if you can get your hands on it. Yeah. And I, of course, you'll understand this. I want one in a box. I'm not going to go just piece it out.
Yeah.
And so, I told my, there's that one. And then there's another one that's, from South America somewhere. And it's this like dragon kaiju-esque that's painted like a turtle. And so I can't remember the name, but it's in a box brand new. It's like $1,500. And it's really tough to sell my wife on something that is like that.
Right. Yeah.
And I can explain all over and tell you like, no, you don't understand. And she's like, no, you don't get it.
The voice of reason. Yeah.
Yeah. So I do love talking Grail pieces, and it's, yeah, it's incredible. So with all that, the last part of the podcast is plugging everything and how people can get a hold of you and how they can get in touch and work on projects, all that stuff. And so if you're still open, I know you're a one man show cooking away. So please plug everything that you need.
Oh, great. Yeah. I mean, if you want to get a hold of me about Sofubi production, info@milehighsofubi.com is the best way to get a hold of me. I'm on that the most, several times a day. And that's the best route to communicate with me. If you want to initially just jump out and say hi and maybe get the ball rolling, Instagram is good. You can DM me there. The reason I like to focus on the emails, because if I get scattered, I get texts, I get DMs, then I get confused. You know, it's easy for me to get confused. I have a lot of irons in the fire. So yeah, shoot that email to me and then, you know, make sure that I'm getting back to you. That's the best thing to do. My retail side, the toys that I produce, falls under Sputnik Supplies. I confused people initially because I have Sputnik Supplies and I also have Mile High Sofubi, and everybody thought it was two different people for a long time. I was like, oh no, this is not what I wanted.
Yeah.
So then they finally were like, oh, wait a minute, so you're the same guy. I said, yeah, it's me. So you can contact me on Instagram and Sputnik Supplies, Sputnik_supplies. And you can see some of the stuff. I need to get more stuff out there. In fact, I'm slowly trying to get my own stuff cast for the shows that are coming up. I'm going to Five Points, but I'm just going to be wandering around. But I'm doing CollectedCon in Chicago, so I'm trying to get some things together for that. And then, of course, DCon up in November, trying to get stuff going there. So those are the two things that I really, really want to push. If anyone has any questions or just general interest in a project or want to know what it might cost, and something I want to put out there. When it comes to projects for soft vinyl, there isn't a one size fits all. Okay, every project's different, so it's the costs are going to be different for the molds. The breakdown is going to be different depending on the design that you're giving me, and you know the casting cost is going to be different because of all those different elements that flow in there. It's hard for me to do one size fits all. Yeah, I've been doing it for 6 years, and I can look at a piece and kind of guess of what it might cost, so I can give you a general idea. But it's not dyed in the wool. That's what I like to tell everybody. So let's get it official and go talk to my A number one guy, Ivan, over in China, who that's where my molds are made in China. I'm very transparent about that. But the beauty about it is the guy that I work with, Ivan is his name that he uses with me. It's not his real name, but I've been working with Ivan for 4.5 years. And now he works exclusively with me now. He's great. The guy's got 20 years, he's got 27 years working for Mattel as an engineer, and he's fantastic. He's my sounding board for some things, and he's definitely my compatriot. He pushes hard for me and supports me 100%. Great guy. And I wouldn't be where I am without Ivan. Ivan's been fantastic.
I need to get Ivan on the podcast. How do I do that? Holy
moly.
I don't know.
I mean, I've never met the guy. Him and I do talk through WeChat all the time. I mean, that's our main communication format and email. And but he's great. I mean, he's fantastic. I talk to him sometimes 2 times a day, morning and noon, you know, because we're on opposite schedules.
Yeah.
My morning's his night and his night is my morning. So we just kind of recycle through, and I'll get stuff from him, you know, before I'm even out of bed, and then I'm responding to him when he's in bed. And, you know, we get this all worked out. A great guy. I'd love to talk to him too. I'd love to go meet him, have a beer.
Oh my gosh. Is there a way that Toys on Tap can schedule that where there's a giant video call between you two and me?
I don't know. I can ask Ivan. I don't know what, if he would be willing to do it, but I'll float it out there for him and see what he says.
Awesome. Awesome. Paul, thank you so much for coming on Toys on Tap. It means the world.
Thank you. You're very welcome. And thank you so much for having me. It's an honor. It truly is.